listeners, I will start by saying I love this next book and guest, the author, Yasmin Farr. The book is called Cook Simply, Live Fully, and it's a philosophy that I can get very close to. I love it. And the book is it's just so packed with information. Our big challenge is to get through what we want to say about it all. Welcome, Yasmin.
Thank you so much for having me. Are you
in New York now, or where are you?
No, I'm actually in Menorca in Spain.
Oh, right. So the plan worked, huh?
Yes, it did work out. It took me a couple of years, but I got here eventually.
No, I missed that. Where are you?
She's in Menorca.
Oh, you are in Menorca.
That's why I said she made it.
Right. So I've never been. Is this very different from mainland Spain and Mallorca?
It has its own feel and pace of life. Like, it's very slow and more flat than Mallorca, but it's great. I mean, I think all of Spain is beautiful, and this isn't an exception.
Yeah, we were in Ibiza, if you remember.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, nice.
Our cousin got married in Ibiza.
Relative of mine, living in London, made sure that many of her relatives went because they told their potential guests, Anne and Peter are coming. What's your excuse for not being there?
Okay,
great.
Well, let's, are you ready to start the interview? Let's get it started because there's so much to cover.
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead, Robin.
We're going ahead?
Yes, please.
Well, we did establish already that our guest is from a somewhat unusual part of the world, shall we say.
Did you start the recording, Rabbit?
Yes. I believe I've been recording for about 5 minutes.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Okay.
That's all right. You knew we'd already started, didn't you, dear?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and you knew that we'd start.
Oh, yeah. I think I heard the recording go on, and yeah. I thought we
okay.
were recording. But it worked either way.
Well, there's so many things, so many aspects of this book to talk about. To start off with, the things you love, you really love fully. You say live fully, but you love fully, too. Like citrus. You have citrus, and it's about everything. I love citrus, too. You also love broccolini. They're a very definite favorite. Chicken thighs, I cook them all the time. So, but how did you develop your cooking style? You were raised on Persian cuisine, which is probably one of the great cuisines of the world.
I think so, too. I love it. But I think, fortunately, Persian cuisine takes a lot of time, and it doesn't really work as well for, quick weeknight meals, which is more of what I've been doing. But I think that plus traveling a lot has given me, a very high standard of food, of, what I expect to eat. But I think I'm also a little bit lazy, so I try to make recipes as quick and as easy as possible, but still have that wonderful full flavor with bright notes from citrus and full of vegetables and really good ingredients. So I think it's drawing on all of my life experiences a little bit.
Yeah, well, you moved around quite a bit, but we kind of share that. I picked up and took off to bum around the South Pacific at one point.
But then I found out
you had to have a specialty. You could just bump. but you do love doing things where you meet people unexpectedly and get very involved in their particular point of view and interest, which I found rather stimulating. Like you would sit at a bar, you're not at a bar, but you'd sit next to strangers and get into conversations with them. You say you didn't mind, you don't mind eating alone because you get to meet new people.
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite things to do, especially when you're sitting at like a restaurant bar. I've had some of the most interesting conversations with people. We've ended up sharing meals, and I learn, you know, where they came from, what their perspectives are, and it's just, it's been illuminating, honestly. And it's just so much fun to meet new people, especially when you're traveling.
Right. Yeah, I like that, too. That's my favorite part of traveling, actually.
Agreed.
Now, tell us a little bit about how you organize this book. I thought that was kind of interesting. We get so many cookbooks, and none of them is organized the way you've organized yours.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, so it's organized by the energy you have to cook dinner and your mood. So there's lap dinners, which are like come together in 15, 20 minutes. There's no prep work. It's for when you're really exhausted. And then there's coffee table dinners, which is more your average weeknight meal and like meant to be when you eat, you know, at a coffee table. And then there's at the dinner table when you have a little bit more energy, you know, maybe and are sitting at the table. So I find that's how I found myself eating and deciding what to cook. So I set up the book that way.
Yeah, well, now you have a lot of formal training in cooking and flavor profiling and that sort of thing. And you've done all kinds of food writing. So you've been at this a while. How long have you been doing this?
I've been very lucky in my career to have worked with so many great editors and so many great publications. So I've been doing this for about almost 15 years, I think. So it's definitely an accumulation of all the things that I've learned and places that I've worked, you know, like Food and Wine magazine or for Forbes Travel Guide and now New York Times Cooking. So, and I've had so many great editors who have really taught me so much, too.
Right. Were you just set about, I mean, you did this book pretty much during the pandemic, right?
I did it a bit after. I think during the pandemic is when I first visited Menorca. Towards the later end of it when we were allowed to travel and things. And that's when I fell in love with the island and decided to leave New York and change my life. So I guess it was sort of the tail end of the pandemic, if you will.
Uh-huh. Right. Were you taking the time to organize your experiences into this book, or were you also exploring new directions and new attitudes towards cooking and food?
Yeah, definitely exploring new ones. Like I think I went in with a plan, and then as I started working on it, you know, so much of my life ended up changing, and it was a really transitional period, and it ended up shaping the tone of the book, you know, having this flexibility and cooking by your mood and energy level. And I think just the ingredients I used were all really influenced by what I was going through and where I was traveling.
Right. You have a section on how to use this book to make your life easier, which is kind of an eye-opener. Tell us a little bit about how you decide what you're going to be cooking.
I think this section is really meant to tell you what's in the book and how you're feeling. So I think I really wanted people to take a second, think about like how they're feeling, how they want to feel after they eat, you know, whether it's they want something comforting or nourishing or something really light and bright. And I find the weather sort of affects me in that decision. And so that's really what I want people to think about, like being present kind of in this moment and figuring out what they need. And then there's also some tools and tips, but they're really minimal tools. It's a very low-tech cookbook.
Yeah, and I like that. I mean, I got so tired of people telling me I need an air fryer.
Oh, exactly. Let's pay for all these things, you know?
You have guidelines under this chapter called Some Things to Know as You Flip Through. And tell us what some of those are.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, they're very useful, I think. One of the big deficits in a lot of these cookbooks that we get is they don't have a general guide of how, overall, to actually use the book.
I agree. Yeah, so in this one, so every oven recipe is set at 400 degrees, so that way you can easily, like, mix and match and swap things around. There's also this, like, vegetable cooking chart to tell you, that tells you, like, the basic cooking times for all the vegetables found in the book. And there's a wine pairing chart, which you can use, like, the main ingredients in the recipes and then match them with the wine suggestion, which my friend as a sommelier wrote. And there's also, this is one of my favorite parts, there's a magenta ruler that's on the spine of the book.
Oh, yeah, I wanted you to explain that. That's very cool.
Yeah, thanks. So when I'm developing recipes, you know, I have this magenta ruler that I think I bought at CVS like 5 to 10 years ago, and I use it to make sure, you know, like my 2-inch piece of ginger is 2 inches or things are cut into a 1/2-inch piece. So I thought it would be helpful for readers to also have that. You can easily, like, you know, take your ginger or take your piece of carrot or whatever it is and match it up to the spine or also inside the book. So just, like, little things to make cooking easier for people.
Right. Now, I mean, I think that, one of the outstanding benefits of this book is that you have, like, sections that you don't usually see in cookbooks, like some fun seasoning ideas. I thought that was fascinating. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think in this vegetable chart, even if it's like basic cooking methods, like once you master that, then you can play around with it a lot. So the idea of that is just different spices, different compound butters, things that you can add to everyday vegetables just to make it feel a little different, because I feel like we all get in ruts where we cook the same thing over and over. So it's nice just to have some new fun ideas.
Right. What are some of your most favorite things? I said chicken. I said citrus. And you also have some other favorite things to always have on hand to cook with.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about some of those?
So I use a spiced cumin a lot, which I know some people may not love, but I think it's a really great ingredient to help, like, layer.
Yeah,
like,
I thought that was very bold, by the way. So many people don't like it, and you just don't. Dove right into it.
Did it. I know. My agent and I were joking, well, if you don't like humans, this might not be the book for you. But I think it's so, you know, because it's not used, like, in such a bold way. Like, I think if used in small amounts, too, just adds, like, a great depth to recipes, especially when combined with other spices and ingredients. But I use, like, turmeric as well, red chili flakes.
There's a book on spices called Spice Heroes. And that was the first one that was was singled out for absolutely the biggest hero of spicing.
Yeah.
And I found myself putting it in everything.
Exactly.
I put it in green tea. Green tea with black pepper, which activates the turmeric. It's fabulous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I think, I only use 6 spices in the book because I think there's so much you can do with those 6 by combining them in different ways. So it's simple, but it's also deeply flavorful. Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you just list what those spices are that you use over and over again?
Oh, of course. So there's cumin, of course, dried oregano, paprika, sumac, and turmeric, and, of course, salt and pepper and red pepper flakes.
Yeah, you know the paprika. I interviewed at one time mentioned that it was great to add to, like, collard greens or anything else where you wanted to have a ham flavor and you don't happen to have a ham shank lying around.
Yeah, if you're using smoked paprika, 100%.
Yeah, pimenton.
Exactly, on pasta, on chicken, and just using a tiny bit gives it so much color and so much flavor.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my essential ones, come to think of it.
Yeah. I think we all have our favorites, too, like the ones we finish quickly before everything else, but these ones are mine.
Right. This is a useful guide, this vegetable cooking chart, because a lot of times people shy away from vegetables that they're not super familiar with. And you take the guesswork out of it.
Exactly. And I think there are nights when you're tired and you just don't want to think. So it's like, okay, how long do I cook carrots for? How long do I cook bok choy for? And just give you really simple ways to do it. Plus those fun seasoning ideas so you can make it different too.
Right. Well, you have a lot of these charts and guidelines in here. But the recipes themselves, did you develop all of them yourself?
Yeah.
Or you built on?
Yeah, all the recipes are mine. The wine chart was written by a sommelier friend of mine, though. So I like came up with different ingredients, and then she would match them. So that was written by someone else. But everything else is me.
The other thing you use over and over again that I'm really fond of, and people don't, it's one of those underused things, is white miso.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's, I mean, in salad dressings, in marinades, like in soups, like it just adds so much. So I think it's something, yeah, that people, because it also can keep in your fridge for so long. So even if you don't think you're going to use it every day, it'll last, and you just might. You never know.
Now, you start out with very simple, easy recipes that for when you're low energy. Is that correct?
Yep, exactly. That's lap dinners.
And then you move on. But even in your fancy section with at the table, you don't get overly precious with these, which is another big gripe of mine.
No. I think everything, honestly, is very simple and easy. Like even the, like you said, fancy at the dinner table is really accessible, and you could do it on a weeknight. Like nothing is more than an hour and a half. It's just that sometimes I might ask you to like use another bowl or make, you know, or do a marinade for a little bit longer. So it's like we need a little bit more time, but it's not anything crazy.
And the other thing I like is you have recipes which you can combine to make it like a more special and important dinner to present.
Exactly. And I think, well, and also in the book, there's a lot of suggestions in recipes of, you know, this dish would go well with this one, or like there's a sides and salad section that can kind of add on to anything else in the book as well.
Yeah, that's very useful. I mean, and you do recommend, though, which is a good thing for people to note, to read the recipe all the way through before you start tackling it.
Exactly.
I learned that the hard way.
Yeah. No, and I think especially for new cooks, and then they're like, wait a minute, what's that step? What happens? And so I think it's so important to familiarize yourself with it, because then you know what's going to happen. Nothing's a surprise, and you might adjust it your way, you know? Yeah.
So, I didn't realize until I was reading in your book that people underutilize the broiler.
Yeah, a lot of people are really scared of the broiler, which I do understand because it's really intense heat, but it's so helpful for cooking, especially for like finishing chicken if you want to get an extra bit of color on it, for quickly cooking shrimp or vegetables, because it's like an upside-down grill, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had ours break down, and I realized how totally dependent we were on it.
Yeah, exactly. It's so helpful, yeah.
So before we started this, I asked you what your ethnic food was, because you seem to have a preference, which I have, for bitter, for citrusy and bitter, both.
There's a lot of
guidelines. And I think that's kind of how you were raised, because that's how I was raised.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and I think, yep.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, no, because I think there's a lot of dried limes that are used in Persian cuisine, and, like, even sumac has, like, a lemony flavor. So I think a lot of that comes from my childhood. You're right, definitely influenced by that.
Well, you know, you said you have a friend who reads cookbooks. Didn't you say that?
I do.
Well,
she always be.
I do the same thing.
Do you? I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this one friend of mine who she always had a weight issue, and she was always jealous that I got such satisfaction out of just reading the recipes and not even actually cooking all of them.
No, I mean, I think it's great, like, especially when cookbooks are full of stories and, like, things about the author or their life. Like, it's like a book. It's for people who love food, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think it's a great
What do you think about besides, besides the fact that that you're casual with, and more relaxed, I guess is a better term, with the recipes and so on, what do you, you obviously are very personalized and personally invested in these recipes. What do you think are the outstanding qualities that you bring to it? You photograph very well. I mean, your photographs all throughout the book, which is perfectly appropriate because the recipes have that flavor. You could tell us by the same person with a particular bent and taste. What do you think, what recipes show your personality the most that you'd like to point out to the listeners?
Ooh, good question. So there's one in the book called Big Cockle Energy, which is like a funny name, but it's like it's frothy clams in them. Like miso, soy sauce, and a bit of chili crisp. And the story behind it is that I was at a restaurant with a friend, and we ended up befriending somebody else and had these amazing cockles and just, you know, after a few drinks, started calling things big cockle energy. And I just think it's one of the recipes that shows kind of the fun approach to cooking, like how, A, we can learn so much in restaurants, but also just enjoy the process and sharing it with other people. And I think most of the recipes as well have this kind of lighthearted, fun tone to them, or that's what I want to come across. So I think that's a good one. And then, yeah, I mean, there are just so many, I would say. But I love them all, so I guess I'm a little biased.
Yeah. You have really some amazing chicken thigh recipes. You know, I hate to cite this source, but... Mario Batali once said that the only point of chicken breast is you could get the thighs and throw away the feed the chicken breast to the dog or something like that.
Throw them to the dogs, he said.
Yeah. But I mean, I always get them, and I usually get it with skin on, bone in as well, like you do.
Yeah, I think there's so flavorful. And I think especially for like a weeknight or even for serving for friends, like they're so easy to make. They're so flavorful and they're forgiving. So even if you leave them in 5 to 10 minutes too long, like they'll be okay. They'll still be delicious. Whereas breast
and
really
they're good leftovers too, which is another good thing.
God. Exactly. Yeah. They're just a good classic, I think.
Now, what I can't remember is, do you do desserts in here? I don't remember.
You know, I don't do really desserts because I'm not really a big dessert person, truthfully.
No,
I
see,
like
we're not. Well, Peter, of course, is English, and he has an insatiable sweet tooth. but we never bothered much with desserts.
Same. I really eat them, so it's never been something that's been fun for me to cook. It's more, I've always been more savory.
Now, how do you keep up with, you're traveling so much, how do you keep up with your writing and exploring the different recipes and so forth? You must be really stressed, I mean, actually.
You know, it's funny, I think in the beginning I definitely was, but I actually got used to it because I was like an undercover hotel and restaurant inspector for 4 years, so I just learned to get used to that pace of always being on the road and working remotely, whether like from a hotel bed or in a cafe, so I can still make myself focus. And then even when writing this book, I was bouncing around different Airbnbs, so I really like whittled down my knife kit to only the essentials and kind of learned to navigate different stovetops and ovens and all these things. So it definitely takes a moment to adjust, but I think once you get used to it, you know how to handle a bit and not get too stressed out. And I think the change is kind of good, too. Or I like it.
You introduce some fruit, rarely, but you do introduce some. I'm looking at the the chicken with the grapes. And
I found
that mm-hmm. I just having entertaining, I found that if you put grapes in anything, they think it's much fancier than it is.
I know. I completely agree. Like, a friend made this, and she's like, wow, everyone thought it was so fancy and elegant, and really, it's like a cheap pan deal. You know? Like, there's nothing really done to it. But it works. Yeah. I think it's so beautiful and colorful, too. You know, like,
they are pretty, aren't they? Yeah.
They're gorgeous. Mm-hmm.
You like pasta a lot.
I do. I love pasta. It's just so comforting.
Mm-hmm. You don't bother with making fresh pasta, do you?
I don't. I mean, maybe every once in a while, but like I said, I don't want to say lazy because that sounds bad, but I think there's a lot of high-quality pasta. I'll buy fresh pasta, but usually it's just something I do for quick meals rather than something more luxuriating, you know?
Yeah. Could you explain to me, I mean, I know essentially what ghee is, but you're really gaga over ghee. And I mean, how is it different from, if you, what is the term when you take regular butter
the whey. Yeah. I mean, it is a type of like clarified butter, but you can use
clarify
it.
Clarify is the word I was talking about.
Yeah, it has a high cooking point, and it's really good for people who have problems with dairy, so they can usually digest that as well. And it just has this, like, wonderful nutty flavor, like, especially when you mix it with miso. Oh, my God, it's one of my favorite things. Like, it smells unbelievable and just tastes so rich, too.
See, I've never really experimented much with that. In fact, we use almost solely olive oil, basically.
Yeah, that's what I've seen mostly until someone introduced me to ghee, and then I've really become quite addicted to it.
Spanish cuisine, I mean, like, mm-hmm. if you think of it, I mean, most, I would say that a lot of ingredients, like olive oil, think olive oil.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a source of olives to feed the world, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So, do you have an overlap with Spanish? I mean, are you interested in Spanish cuisine, per se?
Definitely. I mean, I think the more time I spend here, the more I've learned about it, and I've read some cookbooks, and, you know, I'm trying to learn more Spanish so I can read actual cookbooks, you know, in Spanish or eventually in Catalan. But, I think it's been really nice to learn more about it. And, like, I'm using more olives, more smoked paprika, like, it's finding its way into my food, like more anchovies and things like that. So I think I'm someone who's like easily influenced by where I travel. So you'll see it in my recipe soon.
Yeah. Well, I was very impressed that you learned some Catalan.
Yeah, very slowly.
Do you remember, who was that chef and restaurateur that we interviewed who insisted on, I think it was in Barcelona. It would have been probably. He insisted on doing the whole interview in Catalan.
it was Santi Santa Maria.
Santa Santa Maria, who's dead now, I guess.
Yeah,
but
he had a place just outside Barcelona.
Oh,
and,
wow!
After he died, his wife took over running the B&B and the restaurant. And
oh, I forgot about that, yeah.
I think she probably cooked better than he did.
True. But we had a terrible time. I mean, I've never actually really formally studied Spanish, although, I mean, between French and Italian, I managed to get by. Catalan, I mean, I couldn't. The only thing that was worse was the, what is the Basque language called? I can't even read that. But, we had native Spanish speakers that had a hard time translating from Catalan.
Yeah, I mean, it is different. I'm not sure if someone's saying it's like a little more similar to French than but or like a mashup, but it is different. I can't really read it, and I'm not an expert either of them. Just slowly learning.
Well, now, what is your next project? I'm always interested in how, because, I mean, this is coming to a conclusion with the book published, as much as I've read, it's been very well received, and I loved it. Are you already thinking of your next project? I think cookbook. I don't know why everybody wants to produce a cookbook. I think it's the most tedious thing I've ever had to do.
It's so much work. Honestly, every time I finish one, I'm like, I'm never doing this again. But then,
exactly.
Oh, but I love them. Like, it's so much work. Yeah, exactly. I don't really know.
Is your plan to stay where you are?
I just got here a couple of months ago, so it's still very new. So I think whatever I do next will probably be inspired by this time here, but I think it's still kind of in that early phase of trying to figure it out and seeing what I get excited by. So maybe it'll be a cookbook, maybe it'll be like a food-related book that's more writing. I really don't know. So no good answers. TBD.
Right. Well, is there something that we haven't covered that we should be pointing out to our listeners about this particular book?
I think you've asked some really great questions. Like, it's a book, you know, full of stories, but it's also meant to be really helpful in the kitchen. So something that's, like, used for every day, but also to inspire and, you know, have fun with, which I think, is really the hope.
Well, you know, you don't realize how cookbooks fail in one regard. I mean, I learned from my granddaughter, who's 17, that she loves cooking and food. She can follow all these cookbooks, but what none of them tell her is why.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And you do that. You tell why you do such and such, which is really very important, I think.
No, I think so, too, because also that's how people learn, and then that way they'll probably listen to you rather than think, I don't need to do that. Because giving them the why is like, okay, this is why I have to do it, you know? And I think having a visual cue also helps them in case, you know, their stovetop isn't that strong. So I think, you know, paying attention to what's actually happening in your pan and understanding why it's happening, you know, will just make you a better cook. And that's really my ultimate goal, yeah.
Well, I really am enjoying your book and enjoy it. I knew I was going to enjoy talking to you because I feel there's a kinship here.
And
beyond broccolini, which I also enjoy.
So
I'm going to investigate more sumac because I haven't really ever investigated that.
Oh, it's a good one. But it's great in dressings, like on meats, like as a marinade. There's one in the book with fish and salmon that's really good. It's like a mild lemony flavor and like a nice salt, like coarse texture. So it's great. Highly recommend.
Good. And listeners, I didn't get into this, but you're going to enjoy her directions for seasoning. She doesn't do like a half teaspoon or this or that and the other. She has you rotating the drizzle around the skillet. It's wonderful.
Exactly, like half moon, quarter moon.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wonderful book. Again, Far, and it's Cook Simply, Live Fully. And you sound like you're doing both. So that's great.
Yeah,
thank you for talking to us.
Of course. Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, good luck with your success with your book.
Thank you.
Enjoy your living fully. Enjoy it.
I will. You too. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Turn it off.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
listeners, this next interview you're going to listen to is Dolce, and sweet indeed it is. We're going to be talking to the author, Renato Pollofito, who is, as I am, Sicilian in background. And the book is called Dolce, and it is about sweets, although he does have some savory recipes in here as well. And he has an attitude that you have to grab at right off the bat, is measure everything, use your kitchen scale. And I say that, Renato, I have a kitchen scale I've never used.
Oh, gosh.
Because
we'll break it out.
I don't bake at all.
If you ever did bake, yeah, you would
use it. Oh, I have
to
use
sure.
it. I mean, I have it. It's preserved in great shape. So just briefly, you grew up like in two different cultures. You did Italian, you did American, and you did Italian-American, which would be three cultures, right?
Yeah, basically. They're all kind of different from each other. But, I grew up in Queens, New York, and my parents are both from Sicily, immigrants, and they came here in the late 50s. My dad was basically like, when you enter this house, you are in Italy, but when you leave this house, you are in the United States, you're in America. So I kind of had to live with that kind of duality my entire childhood. It was frustrating for me as a kid, but as I grew up, I learned to appreciate it a lot more.
Yeah, now I have to ask you, your dedication for this book is called Again for My Mom. Now, that means you've dedicated books to her before this?
Yes. Before Dolce, I had a bakery called Baked, and I had co-written four cookbooks with that bakery. And, of course, you know, the first and I believe the third book were dedicated to my mom.
So this is she a great baker?
She was a great cook and a good baker, but her baking repertoire was limited to maybe like four or five things, you know?
Yeah.
She baked savories really well, but when it came to like the sweets, we had an olive oil bundt that was in heavy rotation, like an almond cake, and those little S cookies, if you know what I'm talking about, they're typical Italian kind of like home baker cookies made with a lot of baking soda.
I have to say that this book, with all kinds of other things, listeners, it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the photography is so mouth-watering. overall, and the scenic shots, you want to get on a plane and fly off to Sicily right away.
Yeah, that was the whole point. I mean, I wanted to create a book that felt like armchair travel, you know, like where you could be at home and like flip through a book and really be transported. That was super important to me. And the photographer, Kevin Miyazaki, who shot the book, both the shots in Italy and Brooklyn, as well as the studio shots of the food, did an amazing, amazing job. He and I clicked right away, and he got what I was trying to kind of portray with this cookbook, is that I want people to, like, put it down when they're done with it and say, okay, let me book my trip to Italy.
Oh, listen, I'm so nostalgic because it's, you know, being Sicilian and having spent so much time. Oh, we have something else in common. I also went to school in Florence.
Oh, no way. That's great.
Yeah.
I did the Syracuse University program in Florence in my 20s, and it was my early 20s, and that was the kind of experience that really changed my viewpoint of Italy, that made me really fall in love with it.
Now, the last time we were in Sicily, we were just down the road from a little town called Licata.
Okay.
And we interviewed the chef, who was a Michelin two-star chef. But we had trouble getting a reservation at his restaurant. But Francesco Planetta, stepped into the brink and called him on our behalf because he had his secret phone number.
Oh, no way. it's funny because go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, no, just like restaurants in Italy, it's like it's if they're popular, they're very popular. You know, it's like everybody wants to go. Yeah.
Well, I've noticed
I missed out the most important part of why I told the story, because at the motel we were staying at, we went out for the day, we came back in the evening part of the day, and lo and behold, they had baked a cake for me because it was my birthday.
Oh, no way.
We have a photo of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a hell of a good cake.
Yeah, I mean,
you,
I can imagine.
You know, your cakes are absolutely amazing. I have to get off my chest. The first thing is I ran immediately through the index to find a cucciadata recipe. Now, let me tell you, this was the big thing when I was growing up. Those honey balls that you have in here, too.
This truthfully, but, yeah, totally, yeah. Totally. That's it's so Italian-American and so kind of like brought over from southern Italy, those two particular recipes, which I think is the Italian recipes that we're very familiar with as Americans and as Italian-Americans, are those southern Italian recipes. The struffoli my mom would make around the holidays, and the cucciadati are just, it's basically the, I always call it like the prototype for the Fig Newton, you know?
It used to be a big tradition. A bunch of us would get together and make these cucciadati. But
yeah.
We have a TV chef who is Sicilian here in Pittsburgh. And he does a TV show. He's done this TV show for as long as I can remember. And he had this great idea that we were going to get all the Sicilian chefs together and do a program, a TV program, on public broadcasting PBS station, and we were going to do get all these chefs together, the Sicilian chefs, and make a special program on cucciadati. Okay.
I mean, amazing.
So
amazing.
We all went to our recipe collections, and I couldn't find even among my recipe collections, which are, they all have the family names. This is Aunt Clara's recipe, and this was Aunt So and So's recipe. There wasn't a single duplicate recipe for the cucciadati.
Yeah, they're all, I mean, that's the thing, like they're all different, and that doing research for this book, I kind of realized that when you have 20 regions in Italy, every region kind of stakes claim to certain recipes, and there are slight variations, and there are slight different historical facts about it, but it technically is the same recipe. So, you know, it's interesting to see like how these evolved and like where they're truly from. I was stumped with a lot of them, trying to figure out like, is this the true history of this particular recipe? Because I would go to another region and I'd get a very similar story, but not exact, you know? So everybody wants to.
We never got it together for the show. I mean, nobody had the same recipes. In fact, I have, and none of the measurements, that's the other thing is, I mean, I have Aunt Clara's cucciadata. She was the real baker in the family. Called for a jar of grape jelly.
yeah, that's the thing. Or like a cup of, like a teacup of something or something like that. My mom, like, this is how that's so true, because my mom, who would make this kind of oil-based pound cake, this well, almost like a ciambella della mattina. That's she would have this, and it was a sour cream based cake as well. She would have a little cup of Brake Stone's sour cream, and it was this old cup, and she would measure using that cup, you know. And it was this, she'd be like, okay, so when I was trying to kind of like extract the recipe from her, I'm like, okay, so how much sour cream? She's like, half of this. And I'm like, oh God, okay. So,
you see, I tried this with my grandmother, and she thought I was retarded. her answer was always, until it's right.
Yeah. I mean, that's how they learned, and that's how they would use their own kind of like formulas to really basically recreate the same thing over and over again. But that's why I say use a scale, because you're measuring in grams, the measurements will be exact each time, similar to like what they're doing. They're using one point of measure. And
you do this in your book. I mean, you list the measure, that first, the weight of this first.
Yes, exactly. I know that's a little, edgy for an American cookbook, but it's true. If you're a baker, if you want to bake and you want to bake well, just get a scale. Just measure it all out. Measure out all your ingredients first, and then it just becomes the process of assembly. Like, you're putting it all together in its
right
steps. But you have everything measured out. You have everything good to go, and your end product should be as close to what you want it to be as possible. You know.
Yeah. Did you discover anything new? You had to discover a lot new, because so much was family traditions and differed from family to family and village to village. Is there some surprise that you found out in researching Dolce?
Are there some surprises? I mean, I think the biggest challenge was like trying to figure out like what the real story was. And I feel that Italians tend to add flourishes to any and every story, especially when it comes to sweets and desserts. You know, it's like everything becomes very grandiose. You know, it's like this dessert was created by nuns, and you know, this it's a 2,000-year-old recipe, and you know, the ancient Greeks, you know, like developed this. I mean, I love the historical context, and a lot of it is, you know, like how the Minne di Sant'Agata, for example, which are typical of Sicily and very typical of Catania, because that's where St. Agatha was from, and the story behind
it. I love your riff on that, I mean, in the book.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Sant'Agata.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a fascinating story, and it would be even more fascinating if it were 100% true, you know. It's like,
well, it's...
But
I still remember grade school, and I went to Catholic school, and Catholic girls' school, no less, and I still remember those just dreadful photographs of Santa getting her nipples pulled off.
Yeah, I mean, it's awful. It's tragic, yet there's a whole dessert dedicated to it, and, you know, it's delicious, but, you know, it's torture.
Well, you know, one of the things that really astounded me, that even though I don't bake, I'd be willing to actually try this myself or get my granddaughter to make it, is the cannoli cake. I never heard of such
a
cake.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's my interpretation, because my cafe, Ciao Gloria, we don't really have a deep fryer, so it was like cannoli were basically something that we really couldn't do with any kind of frequency. We have like a little tabletop fryer, and then on Saturdays we make bomboloni, but again, in small quantities, so on and so forth. But the cannoli cake kind of came about that way. I was like, I wanted our customers to have that cannoli experience without having to fry all this stuff. So
is that your kind of creation totally, the cannoli cake?
Yeah. It kind of developed as like, I mean, I've seen cannoli like layer cakes before, like, you know, like sometimes you'll see those at like Italian-ish bakeries where like the cannolis are like stuck on top of the cake. But I wanted something rustic that paid homage to a real cannoli in its simplicity and in its flavor profile. And that's why the cake is like a very simple cake with like studded with candied orange and little chocolate chips and the cinnamon and a little touch of cocoa, you know, and then the frosting on top is basically ricotta. with more chocolate chips and pistachios. So it like it embodies yeah. all it has all of the elements of a cannoli, but in a different form.
Well, you spoke the truth when you said that here are these molds for making cannoli, but it's mm-hmm. not the easiest dessert to make because I have the little forms, you know, the aluminum tubes, and, mm-hmm. and I never made cannoli with them ever.
it's a process, and it's a process to break out the fryer and to do all that. You know, when you're frying anything in kind of like lots of oil, it's a procedure. So that's why the cannoli cake is like, it's in there as a substitute to that cannoli flavor. But then I also have the cannoli croccante, which is similar, but you're basically using those cannoli molds to make the shell from a lace cookie, which is a lot easier to make. So,
well, the shells, by the way, I mean the form, the aluminum tubes, mm-hmm. they substituted when I didn't have a steamer. You just put them underneath your whatever pan you're using, and you can use uh-huh. it to steam.
Oh, no way. That's amazing.
With it.
Yeah,
and your cassata is gorgeous. And I've seen so many versions of cassata, and it's one of the prettiest, most beautiful, glorious desserts that you can see in
yeah.
Sicily.
Thank you.
I mean, you must have an art background too, because your decoration of this cake is gorgeous.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I can't take all the credit. I had a really, really great food stylist help me with the photo shoot, and that kind of like stained glass, like diced fruit around the edges was like almost like a last minute decision. And when he started chopping up the fruit, I was like, oh my God, that is beautiful. Let's just leave it like that, you know? So, but yeah, I do have an art background. I studied art in college, and I started my career as a designer. So it kind of translates into, you know, it kind of shows in the book and it shows in the cafe and stuff like that. It's really, for me as a business owner and a cookbook author, something that is part of the process.
Yeah. Well, what I studied at the University of Florence was La Storia dell'Arte. And it was, I wasn't on any kind of scholarship. I was not on a university-sponsored thing, so we actually stayed there. And I got that's when I fell in love with Italy. I never wanted to leave.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I was there...
A Renaissance villa.
Yeah. It's just...
White
it's
glove
just,
service.
It
was great.
Ugh. Yeah, no, when I was there, I was, like, trying to figure out ways to kind of extend my stay.
Exactly.
yeah, and I was just like, can I transfer to university here or something? And then it kind of didn't work out because it was just too rushed, obviously. But, you know, it gave me that zest to kind of just keep going back. And I, as an adult on my own, I've gone back at least, you know, 24 times, not only to like visit families, but my family, but to just travel around all the different regions of Italy that I had never really been exposed to before.
Right. Yeah, we tried doing different, really different sections all the time. And
yep.
There are a few that... Well, there's a place I hated, Rabbit, in the north.
I don't know. Nobody much liked Catania. I remember.
Catania's Catania.
Most people were turned off by Catania.
No, I'm talking about in northwestern Italy.
Oh, Cinque Terre. Cinque Terre was the place.
Oh, Cinque Terre. I hated it.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand because... My first exposure to Cinque Terre was a really long time ago in, like, the 90s, and it was before it kind of had exploded into, like, the destination to kind of hit in that area, and it was gorgeous. But the last time I went, I was just like, this feels like Disney World, you know, in a way where it's just, you don't see an Italian person, you just see tourists kind of just
milling
about.
I couldn't stand all the the German tourists in the hiking boots that would peer, and you know how you could climb up in those housing units and peer in people's windows. And I just thought it was such an invasion of privacy. I hated it.
I know, and it's like you try to think about a town like this that, like, they obviously need the tourism, but the level of tourism is, like, something they're probably not happy with. You know, it's like I'm sure they're happy to get that money, kind of that income, that influx of money to into the town, but, you know, at what cost?
Right. Well, that's what I feel. So,
yeah.
Now, of all these recipes, like, this is a nasty thing to do, and I usually don't do this, but what's the one that stands out that you've invented that you'd like to recommend to everybody from the cookbook?
Oh, to make? I would say, the one that really kind of stands out to me that I absolutely love is the crostata della nonna. Yeah, it's a kind of an amalgam of the crostata classica, which is you can find at any bar in Italy, which is less your apricot-filled frolla crusted with like a little lattice on top. It's super delicious. You could have it pretty much any time of day. It's just a very classic Italian thing. The crostata della nonna is a mixture of the torta della nonna, which is another classic Italian pastry. Again, frolla with a pastry cream on the inside, usually fully covered and then studded with pine nuts and confectioner's sugar.
Oh, wow.
This I kind of just merged the two together. So you have a frolla crust, pastry cream, a lattice top, and then just like a few pine nuts on top, because pine nuts, I am on the same page with everyone else in the world, are super expensive. So you don't want to use a ton.
You know, I always had on a hand-grown basil and pesto, and I used to make other pestos as well. But I remember Peter went to the Italian market and bought
She sent me with a list that had pine nuts on it.
Yeah, and when I looked at...
Of course, I bought the most expensive pine nuts because I didn't want to come home.
When I look at the pinoli, I almost fainted at the cost of them. So that's when I switched to walnuts for the pesto.
Yeah. I use almonds now, so I mean, I get it. It's crazy how expensive they were always on the higher side, but like now they're just prohibitive.
Now, the grissini, I always associate with Milan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. They're,
I can't remember
very
the grissini in Sicily.
I think that you're talking about the grissini or the crostata?
No, I'm looking at a recipe for grissini, which... They look more interesting than what you get in Milano. But I always associate them with northern Italy rather than Sicily.
They're probably originated in northern Italy. They're very, I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where it's like if you go to kind of like a red sauce joint, like an Italian-American restaurant, sometimes you'll get some mediocre bread brought to your table, or you'll get like one of those cups with like the singular packaged grissini where you can kind of like tear open the little bag and then eat them. And I always found those to be so underwhelming, if not stale. So in the book, I was just trying to figure out like a way that would make them a little more interesting and be able to stand on their own without just being almost like stale bread. It's like here you have a little bit of heat, you have a little bit of cheese, you have something going on. So that's my the savory chapter in the book is like also one of my favorites because I do love savory. I love savory baking and I love cooking as well.
Those I could approach and deal with. The kind of thing that I do. So, now, before, I told you that our grandson wanted and got an ice cream maker for Christmas. And I was hoping to share with him some of your gelato recipes. And you told me about which ones to do. You have variations on it. What would you recommend starting with?
I would say start out with the fior di latte is just like a great baseline. It is it's just like cream. It's like a sweet cream gelato, and not only is it delicious on its own, but it pairs well with mix-ins. It pairs well with like if you wanted to kind of fold in Amarena cherries into it, for example, or if you wanted to make a stracciatella, you could pour in some melted chocolate and just like kind of keep mixing it so it forms these little shards within the fior di latte. So I'd say it's a great base to start off with, but also delicious on its own.
Great. Well, tell him that one. Direct him to make
this
for me.
Tell him to make it for you,
fancy
too.
Fancy ice cream maker. I mean, he's 15, and it just seemed like an odd request for Christmas present.
Hey, I understand his passion. You know, it's like I love gelato. I love ice cream. So, yeah, the more I have of it, the better.
No, just because you're a Sicilian, I want to ask you, what is it called now? We used to call it spinach bread. It was really made with Swiss chard. What's it called? It's
empanada?
It's regular Italian bread.
Is it like an empanada? Is that what you're talking about? It's like stuffed with, or it's folded
into
the dough?
Yeah, you make the regular Italian bread dough, and then you stretch it out, and you, as I said, you know, when we couldn't get Swiss chard, it has a Parmesan cheese. Lydia Bastianich told me that this, what we used to call American cheese, is actually a substitute for something that they actually used in Italy.
Interesting. Okay.
She has the whole book. You know that book?
No, where, I don't actually.
Oh, it's really, what's the name of it? I'm sure you can find it online. She did a whole book on the derivations and creations of Italian Americans. So when I was reading it, I realized all these substitutions that my family used to create Sicilian dishes. It's very interesting.
Because it was back in the day, whatever decade you want to call it, like there weren't a lot. I mean, there were Italian products here, but not at the level they're at today. So when my mom came here in the 50s and she would try to recreate dishes, she used what was easily available to her and affordable at the same time, you know? So I think what you're talking about is similar to a recipe in my book called Empanada, which is my mom used to make it with spinach, olives sometimes, shaved parm or shaved pecorino, it depended, and then anchovy. And then it was like a stuffed pizza in a way. And it was delicious, very salty, very briny, very good. I mean, that's how she would make it when I was growing up. But the version I have in the book is a more kind of my flavor profile, which is more like sausage and mozzarella and pecorino and broccoli rabe. So it's the same concept, but just different flavor profile.
Now let me ask you another question. Nobody I've ever talked to ever heard of this, but we used to have a staple creation from the kitchen called Pasta Indiana.
Pasta Indiana?
Yeah.
No, I've never heard of this.
Spaghetti. With sautéed onions, cauliflower, and something else. What was the other thing? And on it as a sauce.
Interesting.
I've interviewed, I don't know how many Italian cooks of all sorts, or Italians of all sorts, and nobody has ever heard of anything called Pasta Indiana, and it was a staple in my family.
That's so interesting.
They lost the recipe on the Greyhound bus on the way to
the winery.
They lost the recipe on the Greyhound bus on the way to Indiana.
You know what? I did a quick, I'm in front of my computer right now, and I did a very quick search of Pasta Indiana, and one thing came up, and it looks like it's cabbage paneer. It's like Indiana as in like India, the country, not
oh,
like
really?
The state. Yeah, and it looks like it's like a curried pasta yeah. with onion, garlic, capsicum, cabbage, and paneer, which is that Indian cheese.
Yeah,
kind of fascinating.
This yeah, the cauliflower. Cauliflower.
See, what my mom used to do, we used to have a pasta with cauliflower, and it was garlic. You would boil the cauliflower, then cook it, mash it up, add garlic, and then a little bit of the pasta water, and then you would mix your pasta in with that, and then some cheese, and then I would usually, for that, I would toast breadcrumbs and top it with toasted breadcrumbs.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
And that's how
that
I
sounds,
usually make.
That sounds
familiar?
Like
Yeah.
Sounds pretty, yeah.
You could also add, if you want a little more of a flavor punch, because sometimes, you know, if the cauliflower is not salted properly,
right.
you can add, like, some cubed pancetta or bacon or prosciutto or something
like that
to kind of mix it in and kind of zhuzh it up. But, yeah, that's one of my favorite dishes, believe it or not.
Well, I love it, too, but I never could locate it. Well, listeners,
I want to
go and have dinner with Renato Pugliafito, and we're going to have all of the savories and conclude with a lot of really gorgeous dolce.
Of course.
Renato, love talking to you. Makes me very homesick, actually.
Oh, well, we'll have to go to Italy together.
And Sicily, too, and particularly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Totally. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, and I can hardly wait to see what our grandson does with your gelato recipes.
Yeah, let me know.
Okay. All right, stay in touch, because you write a lot of cookbooks, so stay in touch with us.
I will, for sure. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Can you stop the recording?